be rewarded for their punctuality, we will start on time. The University Museum is very pleased to participate in Golden Days in Fairbanks, and as part of our own part in the Golden Days celebration, we have come up with four separate features, if you will, during this week. One, as you may already know, is a special show that lasts through August entitled Fairbanks, Gold Pans to Pipelines. It's a special exhibit that you'll find out in the lobby. It takes Fairbanks from its inception up to the present day. The second thing that we'd call your attention to is that the gold exhibit is here and on view. We'd invite you to see that over in the main gallery while you're up here. And lastly, on Saturday, the Carl Ben Eielson airplane, the Jenny, will be in the parade, and following that, within a week or two after that, will be placed out at the International Airport and will be hung there for all of our visitors and local people, for that matter, to see at their leisure. A very special feature that we have, and we're very decidedly proud to present this program today, is Dr. John Whitehead. Dr. Whitehead is an associate professor of history at the university. He is our featured speaker today. And very appropriately, he has chosen to speak on Alaska's true golden days. And without further ado, John Whitehead.
Well, I thought during this Golden Days celebration to give you a little bit of an idea of what we're celebrating, that we'd go back a little bit and see what things were like around the turn of the century up here in Alaska, when the gold that we're celebrating was pouring out of the creeks and streams of the Klondike, which is not really in Alaska, but in Canada, from Nome up here on the Bering Coast, and from our own little Fairbanks right here, because it was right in the years from about 1897 to about 1910 that the Golden Days were really in their great heyday. And so I thought I'd share with you today a few of the interesting characters who came up here to Alaska at that time, and also to make a few observations on the problems that Alaskans ran into back in those first golden days, and what their hopes and aspirations were. Now, to get a sense of what was going on in Alaska at the turn of the century, one thing you need to keep in mind is that people in the western United States were in perpetual motion. We think that today with jet planes and modern transportation that it's a whole lot easier to get around and that we must be traveling a whole lot more than people did 80 years ago. Well, if you look at what those people were doing, to them, distances were much less oppressive in 1900 than they seem to a lot of us today. And anywhere that adventure and profit lurked, Westerners would go. So if you run into any of the famous Westerners, you'll tend to find that they were moving all the time from one town to another in the West. And coming up to Alaska, as long as there was a buck to be made, wasn't a great journey for a lot of them. And so with this in mind, I thought I'd tell you a little bit about how Wyatt Earp, the famous gunslinger from the OK Corral in Arizona, happened to come up to Alaska in the years 1897 to 1901 with his wife Josie, a woman who loved every minute of life in Alaska, and what they were doing about this time. Well, where was Wyatt when the gold was discovered up in Alaska? Well, the old boy was with his wife, Josie, in San Francisco, where he was asked to referee a prize fight. Well, both sides were betting heavily on their respective fighter, and no matter what Wyatt decided in that prize fight, he was going to offend one side. So poor old Wyatt tried to referee this prize fight. The losers, the people who were betting on the loser, then tried to run him out of San Francisco. He found himself in Yuma, Arizona, when he heard that there had been the famous Klondike gold strike up here in the Yukon. So Wyatt said to his wife Josie down in Arizona, "We don't have anything else to do. Let's go to Alaska." So Josie, that was the wife's name, and Wyatt, started out on a boat from San Francisco. They came up through southeast Alaska, stopped at Wrangell, where Wyatt was asked to be acting deputy marshal for a day. And in his first day on the job, he broke up a gunfight in a saloon, only to have one of the shooters embrace him and say, "Why, Wyatt Earp, I didn't expect to see you here in Alaska. You threw me in the jail in Dodge City back in 1880. I thought I could come to Alaska and be free of you, but here you are." So old Wyatt and the boy he'd arrested for the second time had a right good time at Wyatt's first stop in Alaska. Well, what Wyatt and Josie were going to do was to take the famous Chilkoot Pass. Now, if some of you are on tours and have gone up the Inside Passage, I'm sure the guides have showed you the Chilkoot Pass. Well, old Wyatt and Josie had gotten up to Skagway and were about to take the Chilkoot Pass when two things happened. Josie realized that the weather was coming in pretty heavy. Wyatt had popped his hip trying to jump on a trolley to get out of San Francisco pretty fast back there with the prize fight. Josie also realized that she was quite pregnant at the time, and with Wyatt's bad hip and her potential baby, she didn't want to go over the Chilkoot Pass that winter. So Wyatt and Josie, remember these people are always traveling, went back to San Francisco. The next year they said, "Let's try Alaska again." So they decided to take, they'd taken one of the cruises to Alaska. They thought they'd go the other way this time. So the other way that people were going to the Klondike was to sail through the Aleutian Islands up here to a little port of St. Michael's on Norton Sound. And then the big adventure was to take a steamer down the Yukon River, and then eventually they would wind all the way across Alaska and over here to the Klondike, where they could make their fortune. Well, the great adventure, really, of taking the Yukon was seeing if you could get all the way to the Klondike before the river froze up. Well, rarely did people ever make it all the way to the Klondike in one fall. Well, poor old Wyatt and Josie started out on the Yukon, and by the time they had gotten to a little village, which, if I can find, the village of Rampart, which is up here. Where are we going to find? Well, Rampart's up here. Oh, there it is, right there. They got all the way to Rampart, and the river was freezing up on them. So Wyatt and his wife had to spend the winter of 1898 in Rampart, Alaska. Well, I think if any of us had to spend the winter in Rampart today, we'd be pretty depressed. But this was back in 1899, but as far as Josie was concerned, that winter was wonderful, because half of the rest of the world was stuck in Rampart that winter. They met a man who later became a good friend named Tex Rickert. After he got out of Rampart, he went back to Bill Madison Square Garden in New York. A number of ex-governors of the state of Washington ran into the ice that winter. Young medical students from the East were trying to get to Dawson. They were there in Rampart. So as far as Josie was concerned, they had quite a good old winter there in 1899. To listen to her diaries, it was one party after another. In fact, one night, the captain of a riverboat said, "Well, my riverboat's frozen out here in the river. Let's have a party." So they had a party on the riverboat, and as a joke, the captain frosted an old life preserver and told him it was angel food cake. So all of them cut into the life preserver and took a bite and almost had a fit. But then he did produce a real angel food cake there on the river in Rampart in 1899. Oh, one victim goes. Okay. Ha ha ha. anyway, after the river unfroze at Rampart, the Earps sailed back down because they heard there'd been a big strike of gold on the beach at Nome. So they sailed back down the Yukon, set up shop in the summer of 1899 there in Nome, where Wyatt built a saloon, which he called the Dexter, and along with 200 other saloon keepers, Wyatt Earp and his wife set up shop there in Nome, Alaska. Again, Josie thought it was wonderful. They took a winter trip out to San Francisco to buy furnishings for the saloon that would make it one of the most elegant spots in all of the West Coast. The only problem the two got into in Nome was that Josie got tired of the Arctic nights and started gambling a little bit too much. She would wander to all the gambling halls, and it wasn't so much that she was gambling that upset Wyatt, it was that she was losing. So finally, Wyatt told Josie to stop gambling, and Josie was no clinging violet or shrinking violet to be pushed around in 1900. She told Wyatt, stop me, see if you can. So Wyatt, who had an interest in most of the saloons, just went around and put out the word that no one was to gamble with Josie. Well, after she quit her gambling, what was the problem? Josie said, well, Nome has 20,000 people. It's just become humdrum, like any other town, any place else in the world. There's no more excitement here in Nome, Alaska. The frontier vanished overnight. So Wyatt and Josie sailed away from Nome with fond memories of all of their friends, to meet them later again in other gold camps in Arizona or Colorado. So the gold brought the Wyatt Earps to Nome, Alaska. Also, about this same time, misadventures on the Yukon of people trying to get over toward the Canadian boundary, but never getting there, led to the founding of our Fairbanks. Because right after the Earps left from Nome, some little prospectors started to think there might be some gold here in the Tanana Valley. So a rather unknown young man who had fled the law, named E.T. Barnett, thought that if he could get a load of goods, once again from St. Michael's, he was hoping to take them up the on the Yukon down the Tanana to a little town here called Tanacross, where gold miners who were coming up from Valdez could get supplies from him. But for whatever reason, Barnett didn't make it all the way to Tanacross in the summer of 1901. He was trying to get around this little area, which had no name then. He took off the Tanana River onto the Chena, but his boat wouldn't go any further. The man who was piloting it for him said he wasn't going to take the boat any further. He thought it would get stuck. So Barnett, in the summer of 1901, stopped down on the banks of the Chena near where Nordstrom's is downtown. This was the worst possible place he could be. Unfortunately, he had his wife with him, who wasn't all that excited to have taken a trip on the Yukon and Tanana and to be stuck in the middle of nowhere in August of 1901. The two of them were having a wild fight. You can imagine it. I'm not going to go anywhere with you anymore. I'm trying to be a devoted, loyal wife, and what have you done? You've stuck me in the middle of nowhere. Well, while the two were really going at it, a miner named Felix Pedro supposedly saw the smokestack from their boat and came rushing down to find the Barnetts there on the banks of the Chena. We're told that Pedro said to old Barnett, there are a lot of miners in this area. We haven't discovered any gold, but you stay here and the miners will buy your goods. Well, I suppose old Barnett's wife Isabel said, well, you've got nothing better to do. You've got us stuck here. You might as well just build a house and let's make the best of it. So anyway, old Barnett set up his store here on the banks of the Chena, and Isabel said, well, you've got your store and you can stay here, but not me. And so she persuaded him to go back out that winter so they could get another boatload of goods and hopefully try to get maybe down to Tanacross the next summer. Well, then, by the time they got back in July of 1902, old Felix Pedro had made his discovery of gold. And if you go out here on the Steese Highway to the Felix Pedro monument, that's where the famous strike was made. So Pedro said, "Don't worry, Captain. We've got a gold strike here. It's going to be a boom city just like Nome. Stay here. You'll be the town's leading father." So Barnett decided to make a permanent settlement, and he named it Fairbanks because a friend of his, Judge James Wickersham, had said, "There's a senator in the Congress named Fairbanks. He might help us out a bit if we named a town for him." So Fairbanks was founded named in 1902. Well, there wasn't a whole lot of gold in Fairbanks, and poor old Barnett had all these goods he wanted to sell. Well, what do you do if you have a lot of goods to sell and there's not a whole lot going on in your community? Well, you go around lying to people that there's some reason to come to your little spot. Well, old Barnett had in his troop a Japanese cook named Jujiro Wada, whose most famous claim to notoriety was that he was a marathon runner. So Barnett said to Wada, "Why don't you run over to Dawson and tell the people there's gold in Fairbanks. There won't be any gold, but they can buy these picks and shovels we have." So Wada ran to Dawson, thus this being the first real marathon race in Fairbanks history, ran to Dawson, told them there was gold in Fairbanks. And then up here in Rampart, there were some army lieutenants who were surveying for a telegraph line to Siberia. And so one of the army lieutenants wandered into Fairbanks. Old Barnett took him aside. He had dropped some gold flakes down into a hole and said to the army lieutenant, "There's gold here in Fairbanks. Go back to Rampart and tell everybody to come to Fairbanks." Well, the lieutenant did that. So with the people following Wada from Dawson and the army people coming down from Rampart, they all got to Fairbanks looking for the gold, only finding Barnett's store. Just as they were about to hang him, old Judge Wickersham came into Fairbanks and set up a court and arrested all the people who wanted to hang his friend Barnett. Well, the judge and the captain couldn't have held off all the hangers forever, but fortunately, gold did appear in Fairbanks, and by about 1906, Fairbanks was a booming, bustling city. So in these golden days, we got two really big boom towns, Nome with almost 20,000 people, Fairbanks pushing up to 5,000 and 6,000 people in these golden days. And there are two things that to me are striking about this old heritage. Both Nome and Fairbanks, almost from their beginnings, were not the wilderness or the frontier, but they quickly became cities overnight with all the modern comforts. Telephones, telegraph. Fairbanks in the early days was heated by an electrical plant, which then sent all the steam underground to heat all the buildings in Fairbanks. Well, if you pick up the newspaper today, the Fairbanks Municipal Utilities is now thinking of heating the whole city with steam pipes running under the ground. Well, this was all done in the frontier days of Fairbanks. In fact, if you look at old pictures of Nome, and if you've had, well, this is Fairbanks, we can be proud of it. If you've had the misfortune to go to Nome, Nome was a whole lot more interesting in 1901 than it is today. There's only one or two saloons then. You had 200 to choose from in 1900. The Nome of 1900 was a whole lot more sophisticated and prosperous than is the Nome of today. So Alaska's golden heritage is not really one of rugged pioneers, but of rather sophisticated ones. Josie Earp reported in Nome that most of the time she had to refuse invitations to parties. There was just too much to do. And if you go and look through our Fairbanks exhibit outside, though there's that charming table made with the caribou feet, really the articles from Fairbanks' early days are the cut glass punch bowl and the chafing and the silver chafing dish. If you read newspapers from the time, what do you come across but advertisements for feasts, ladies get your ball gowns, cut glass candy dishes. The Fairbanks and the Nome of the olden golden days were really rather sophisticated cities. Also, the leading figures in those gold rush towns were not people who were whining because they were stuck in one place. They were always coming and going. Josie and Wyatt were going to San Francisco for the winter, and E.T. Barnett, his wife Isabel, wouldn't let him stay in Fairbanks a moment. He was either going to Mexico to mind his banana plantation or down to Kentucky to look out for his racehorses. So these old pioneers up here in Alaska were always traveling somewhere else. So in the golden days, isolation was not really a factor up here in Alaska. People were going anywhere they wanted to. So part of our golden heritage is really a rather comfortable heritage. It wasn't Little House on the Prairie up here in Nome. You don't get any stories of Grandma and Grandpa in the sod house, and 20 years later, Mama was happy that running water finally came to Fairbanks and that there was finally an electrical light bulb. Old Mama only had to wait about 6 months, even if she was on old Captain Barnett's boat, before light bulbs and telephones and central heating were all up here in interior Alaska. So it wasn't a rugged, isolated time that those old pioneers had. Well, what was seen then as problems up here in this sort of frozen paradise of the golden days? Well, Alaskans were worried about one thing. And what was their problem? It was their image. Alaskans were concerned that people outside of the state thought they were kooks, that they didn't have the right impression of what Alaska was really about. People thought that Alaska was a land of ice and snow. They also thought it was a land just filled with semi-barbaric characters, rough men who came to get rich quick. Alaskans were worried that the outside had the wrong view of their women. Said one commentator, "They think that our women are just demoralized creatures clad in male attire, rushing from mining camp to mining camp." So Alaskans sat around worrying that people had the wrong idea about them. Also, Alaskans said they don't realize the great agricultural possibilities of our state. People don't think you can grow anything up here. Why, we've got to find some way to bring settlers up here who'll have nice little happy farms. So Alaskans worried and worried and worried that people on the outside thought that they were kooks. Well, what could you do about it? What could you do in 1905 to improve your image? Well, they thought, well, let's turn to public relations and the tourist industry and businessmen, and we'll put on a great World's Fair in Seattle, and all sorts of people can come out on package tours from Minneapolis, and then we'll have wonderful exhibits, and that'll show what the real Alaska is like. And then people won't think that we're kooks anymore. So various Alaskans went down to Seattle and persuaded some businessmen to put on a great World's Fair that would take place in Seattle in the summer of 1909. The business people in Seattle raised $1 million, and the state of Washington gave $1 million, which would be used to build the fairgrounds on what is now the campus of the University of Washington. So this would all be a great festival, and people would get the true idea of Alaska. In fact, so many people got excited that they wanted to have exhibits from the Yukon and also from the Pacific Ocean. So the Alaskan World's Fair quickly became the Alaska-Yukon-Pacific Exposition. So Alaskans were engaged in the golden days in a great effort of public relations. Well, one thing they had to do was to get the U.S. Congress to give them enough money, because Alaska wasn't a state then. It wasn't even a territory. It was a district and had no money to put on any exhibits, because it had no legislature and no taxes. Well, the Congress finally appropriated about $500,000 in the summer of 1908. Well, that didn't leave a whole lot of time to get things in order for Seattle Fair opening in June of 1909. But anyway, some government bureaucrats were quickly sent up to Nome and Fairbanks and all the other spots in Alaska to see if they couldn't put on an exhibit of what the true Alaska was really like. Well, some of those poor old bureaucrats didn't read the boat schedules. They got stuck up here in Nome and Rampart and Fairbanks, just like Josie and Wyatt had in the winter of 1908. So, if you know, it's usually fashionable to criticize bureaucrats as never working, but if you'd worked for the Interior Department or the Smithsonian Institution and you got stuck in Rampart, Alaska in the winter of 1908, then you might not think that all bureaucrats do is just sit behind desks and push paper. Well, they were probably pushing a lot of snow in that winter. So the agents went all over these various cities here and got people excited about putting together an exhibit on the true Alaska. Well, they clipped a lot of vegetables off the vine in the summer of 1908, and of all things, sent them down to Seattle, where they were placed in cold storage until June of 1909. School children collected seeds to have an Alaskan garden down in Seattle. Businessmen in Nome said they'd have a bit of gold from every creek in the whole Nome area. So everyone sort of got caught up in the excitement of showing people what the true Alaska was all about. In fact, on the ladies' side, women's auxiliaries were organized in every Alaska city, and the gals were told to start doing needlepoint and embroidery so the people down in Seattle would know that Alaska was civilized. So in Fairbanks during the winter of 1909, there were a lot of marathon contests held. They had a big arena in Fairbanks with an indoor track. Old Wada, who had run to Dawson back in 1901, thought he would win, but he was beat out by Nick the Greek Damara. So poor old Wada, shame after all these years, but if you'd run back and forth to Dawson many times, you might be exhausted too. Old Wada, after he lost the race, put a note of apology in the Fairbanks newspaper and said he would have to leave the city now that Nick the Greek had beat him. So anyway, Nick was going to be the representative of Fairbanks running the foot races down in Seattle. So all of Alaska had gotten very excited there in 1909 to finally show the rest of the country what the real Alaska was really like. So the fair opened in June of 1909, and we've got a few pictures here of that World's Fair, which we're going to show just for a few minutes. What's happened to Terry?
He got arrested.
Oh, did Terry get arrested? Oh, well, if he got arrested, maybe we'll have to... Oh, okay. We're going to look at the... Oh, he got out of jail. Okay. We're going to just show you a few of these pictures, and one thing, if you're going back to Seattle and you go out to the campus of the University of Washington, you can still see some of the pools and fountains that were left over from that fair.
Which one do you want to see?
Just the other book. Yeah. We'll see a few of these and then...
That's
you'll see sort of how grand this fair was that was put on in 19. Okay, we'll get some focus here. Okay, this was the exhibit building. This was the exhibit building that the federal government put on, with a great cascading fountain going down the front. So this was thought to be the great spectacle of the fair, was this cascade. Okay, can we go back and let's see what the next one is. Okay, this was President Taft who came to visit the fair in 1909, and everyone was hoping that he'd get the right idea about Alaska and make Alaska a state. In fact, if you go out there and look at the gold exhibit, there was this big gold tusk, which was made by the city of Fairbanks with all sorts of elaborate gold inlay to give to old Taft to see if he would come around. Well, the old fellow turned out to be a schmuck, and rather than telling the Alaskans they could become a state, before he was president, he had been governor of the Philippines, in which he ruled it with an iron thumb, and he suggested that Alaska be ruled just like the Philippines, as a colony. So, I mean, people today still get upset that the federal government runs Alaska like a colony. Well, this is the old boy who started pushing that. So I think it was only just that the Tafts gave back that gold tusk to the museum because he was sort of did a dirty trick for the present that we gave him. So this tusk is out there in Alaska, and maybe if he had voted us to be a state here, his family would still have it. But anyway, there was old William Howard Taft. You may know if you watched the show on television, Behind Stairs at the White House, he was so huge and enormous, weighed over 300 pounds, that he got stuck in the White House bathtub a number of times. But anyway, there was old Taft visiting the fair. Well, we had the Pope come to Anchorage back in April, but he was probably the most distinguished person to come and look at things about Alaska up until then. Let's see what our next one is. Okay, this is the building that the federal government built to house the Alaska exhibit in. So if people say the federal government's never done anything for Alaska except take our money out, way back in 1909, at least they built us an exhibit building down in Seattle. So this was where people were going to find out the truth. I think we'll get that one other one, which is a little bit of the exhibit, and I'll tell you a little bit about the fair. Well, this was the. Well, this is part of the mineral exhibit. You can see they were very patriotic with all their flags. And this is supposed to be a big mound of gold ore that was down there at the fair in 1909. Well, this. We'll just flip the lights back on now. I'll tell you a little bit more about this fair. Also, if you are down in Seattle, if you've ever been out to the campus of the University of Washington, there's a huge pond right out in the middle of it, which I'm told is now called the Freshman Pond, but it was originally called the Arctic Circle, and that's a leftover from this World's Fair of 1909. So, with tourists coming in on cheap railroad tickets to Seattle to see the truth about Alaska, what were they going to find? Well, in this Alaska building, the big drawing card was the gold exhibit. That's what everyone wanted to see. It was probably the most elaborate gold exhibit ever put together. It was in a huge case that would rise and sink from the floor. And the case was on an automatic time clock, and when the fair opened its doors at 9 a.m, the case would automatically rise up out of the ground, and when the fair closed at 6 p.m, the clock would automatically lower the case back into the floor. It had over $1 million worth of gold in it, and in 1909, gold was only worth $20 an ounce, so what would that be? About 30 times as much gold as $1 million would be worth today. Also, the largest Eskimo village in creation was transplanted down to Seattle. There was a 1,000-pound copper nugget, then the largest in the world. The fruits and the vegetables from Alaska supposedly attracted a little bit of attention, and we're told that the embroidery that the ladies sent to the fair resurrected the views of most Americans about the caliber of Alaska women. That if the gals were up doing nice embroidery and weaving rugs, Alaska couldn't be as bad as many people think. And if you go outside and look at the Fairbanks exhibit, there's a nice little bit of embroidery done in Fairbanks about that time, and that was an example of what supposedly resurrected the view of Alaska women. Well, by the time the fair was over, almost 4 million people had gone through it, hopefully seeing the truth about Alaska. It was hoped by the promoters of the fair that millions of people would rush up here and settle on happy family farms, and Alaska would just become another state like those in the Union. So if we look back to this old golden heritage of Alaska, what do we find? Really, it's modern cities, public relations firms, package tours, and spectacular world's fairs. These were all a part of Alaska's golden heritage. Now, what strikes me is that as we look back to our heritage and then we look at the present day, what has changed? Alaska in its true golden days and in 1981 is almost the same. Today, Alaskans are still relatively rich and live in comfortable surroundings. And if we go to the source of Alaska's new modern wealth, that is oil, we find that things are just as comfortable as they are any place else in the country. I was up to Prudhoe Bay last weekend, and it reminded me a lot of what Fairbanks was advertised as in 1906. All the areas were called camps, and there would be on the bulletin board Camp News. Also, there were various athletic events posted up on Prudhoe Bay. Who had won the July 4th regatta, like Fairbanks in 1906? Who'd won the 4th of July tug of war? And do you find people up at the source of Alaska's wealth today living in rugged pioneer conditions? No, up at Prudhoe Bay, people are living in better comfort than they do down in Fairbanks. Look out in the Fairbanks exhibit at the menus that were served up during when the pipeline was built. And I had two meals at the Sahio camp on Prudhoe Bay, which were better than anything we found in Fairbanks or Anchorage. So even today, like back in the golden days, wherever there's wealth and opportunity, you find a lot of people living not in rugged conditions, but in comfortable, nice surroundings. The people in Prudhoe Bay, like Wyatt and Josie Earp, are not isolated at the top of the world. They get on a plane every 8 days and fly to Anchorage, just like Josie and Wyatt would get on the boat and go to San Francisco. The only thing that's different about Prudhoe Bay than Nome or Fairbanks is it hasn't attracted its Wyatt Earps, because with no guns, no liquor, and no gambling, there isn't a lot to keep people like Wyatt happy. So then and now, Alaskans live in comfort in fairly modern conditions. And what are we worried about in 1981? the same thing we were worried about in 1905, our image. We still get upset that people think Alaska is a land of ice and snow. Only back in the spring, the governor of Alaska commissioned a public relations firm, just as he might have done in 1905, to find out what Alaska's image is. Well, some awfully upsetting statistics came back. Only 85% of the people surveyed in the lower 48 thought Alaska was a state. Another 4% thought it was still a territory, 5% thought it was a separate country, and 4% didn't know what it was at all. When asked how much of Alaska was covered all year by ice and snow, almost 90% of the people responded that at least a fourth of Alaska was covered by ice and snow all of the year. Half the people surveyed thought that at least half of Alaska was covered by ice and snow. In reality, the percentage of Alaska which is permanently under an ice cover is 5%. So the land of ice and snow image still exists. And what about the kooky image? When people in the lower 48 were asked, would you say people who choose to live in Alaska have the same basic attitudes and characteristics as people who live in the rest of the U.S., 53% of those people surveyed said Alaskans were different, that they weren't like other Americans. When asked why they were different, about a fourth of those people surveyed said they're different because they're more adventurous, daring, and self-reliant. Self-reliant in a state where 43% of the people are on the government payroll, well, that shows a little bit of an anomaly. Well, anyway, so the statistics still show that our image is still the thing that worries us the most. Also, we're still upset that novelists portray our people as semi-barbaric madmen and mad women. If you were in Fairbanks last fall, when an Eastern type named Joe McGinnis wrote a book called Going to Extremes, in which he delighted in talking about a bush pilot who had half of his face shaved and half of his face with a beard, and various other exotic people who could barely keep body and soul together, Fairbanksons went bananas saying, how can anyone come up and portray our people like this? So there's still the image that Alaskans are sort of kooks. We're still upset in Alaska that our agricultural possibilities have not been exploited. In 1981, we're probably as dependent on the outside for food as we were in 1901. Even old Josie Earp noted that in 1900, Nome had one milk cow which tried its best until the population reached about 10,000 and the old cow couldn't go anymore. Most of the milk in Fairbanks today has traveled further than some of its people, having come up from Seattle. So we're just as dependent in 1981 on the outside as we were in 1901 and still upset about it. So what are we doing in 1981 that's any different from 1901? Well, to correct the image, the governor wants to hire a public relations firm now to come out with a movie to give the true image of Alaska. We have endless forums on the agricultural possibilities of the state. Happy cows will one day graze on the tundra. Wheat from Alaska will bake happy bread and we'll all be self-sufficient and wonderful. The state will spend millions for the odd tomato to grow someplace out in the Arctic. So we still are convinced we have to push this agriculture. If you want to walk down the hill, we have a nice little agricultural experiment station where you can see huge sunflowers and cabbages and celery. So we still think in 1981 as in 1901, that for some reason we've got to have farmers up here. We tried to have a World's Fair a few years ago, but that flopped. New Orleans beat us out. So what do we have in its stead? Well, we have package tours coming to our own Fairbanks Museum, where we have a gold room, although the exhibit does not rise and fall from the floor. At least it attracts interest. We do have a copper nugget, which is now 5,000 pounds instead of 1,000. And we have embroidery on the walls so that you'll be assured about Alaska women. And at least last summer, we had a cabbage or two outside, not kept in cold storage in the winter, but growing. So we're still hoping here with our museum to give you the correct image about Alaska. So things then and things now are still pretty much the same. In 1981, as back in the past, Alaskans are still a fairly prosperous and comfortable people, constantly worrying that outsiders think they're kooks. Alaskans are still people who've prospered from panning gold and drilling oil while secretly worrying that they really should have been milking cows and growing wheat. So what has this 80 years of worrying all the way to the bank done for Alaskans? Well, it would probably drive most people crazy, but it does keep those who choose to live here, who are basically different, vibrantly alive. So when we celebrate our golden days in 1981, we can well think that this is just a festival which began in 1901 and no one realized that the sun had gone down. Because what we're celebrating in 1981 is really not a past that's been gone. We're not celebrating what we were, but what we've always been. So if you tap some of the ladies on the shoulder this week who are wearing the old-time outfits, one of the gals may say to you, "Is it over? Is it 1902? I thought the party was supposed to end one night." And she may still be going strong. So Alaska's true golden... E.T. Barnett and his wife Isabel found that they had been stuck in the middle of nowhere. So I hope you'll look around our museum, see some of these exhibits from the old times, wander down to the experimental farm, see the cabbages, and rest assured that you didn't arrive in Alaska too late, you didn't miss the frontier heritage, you didn't miss the wild people. They're all still out there having waited for you all these years. So have a good time on your stay in Fairbanks.